Sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. It's quite a few weeks since I was last sitting up here. Fairly near the start of the retreat time. And over the last weeks, people have been practicing, first of all the group practice and then the more individual style of practice. And now we're about to start with some more group practice. And the sense that the retreat is going along very kind of in a gentle, low-key kind of way. That's the impression. Nothing too kind of major or dramatic. Maybe perhaps minor crises, but the general impression is it's been a very fairly gentle time. In some ways pretty steady for most people. For myself, it's been a bit different, rather a different kind of retreat. It's felt gentle, and at some level, it's felt steady, but externally, it's been quite dramatic's too strong a word, but it's certainly been very powerful. Because as you know, I set off to spend 2-3 weeks down in Devon to have some self-retreat time in the monastery there. And on my way down, I went to visit this very close friend who was about to die. At least that was what my assumption was. I went to see her and had a very very lovely meeting, very potent. We laughed quite a bit, but we also we sort of expressed appreciation for one another, thanked each other, and both of us completely lost it in terms of our emotional capacity. We sort of crying away. It was very like sort of Hollywood deathbed scene. Lots of tears and drama. And very touching actually. I was quite, well, obviously very moved to be saying goodbye to somebody that I'd known for 30 years or so. And shared a lot with somebody who's a very, very good friend who had been very supportive to me all through my monastic life. I think there's something very precious about having somebody who kind of believes in you. is definitely kind of on your side. And it was a friendship I valued greatly. And so, sort of this, sort of the first leave-taking was very moving. And so then I went off down to Devon for my retreat, and she'd asked if I wanted to know when she was actually dying, and I said, well, yes, that'd be great if you could, you know, if a message could be sent. So I went down and began my self-retreat time and had a really lovely time. Devon's a very nice place to go for retreat. I was staying in the this wagon kuti, which is up on a hill. It's very small. I like very small space. It's the kind of space that you don't actually have to get up and move around in. You can just reach out for anything that any of your needs are there within kind of arm's reach. So I could sort of sit there, and if I felt like having a cup of tea, I could kind of open the cupboard, and this little kind of Kalagas burner was there, and sort of heat up some water and have a cup of tea. And it was very, very easy place to be for me. I really liked it, and this big window. So I'd sit up on the bed and just look out of the window and see the sun coming up and the very, very dramatic sort of sonne lumière effect. So you have this dramatic sunrises, bright, bright red sun and incredible cloud formations, and you just watch the sky. And it was very, very powerful just to see how much it changed. There was a constantly changing variety of visual impression throughout the day. And interestingly enough, the only day that it didn't really change was a foggy day. It was one day when it was just very, very misty for hours and hours. You looked out and you couldn't really see anything very much, just this fog. And for me it was quite a powerful image in relation to what happens in my mind. Sometimes when in practice, particularly in retreat time, you can get into this foggy state. Maybe it's not familiar to anybody else, but it's sort of dull, foggy state where everything looks dull and dreary and foggy and depressing and not very clear. And I can struggle a lot with dull, foggy states, and they seem very kind of solid, very fixed. It seems to take a while before they change. And it was interesting with this dull, foggy day, kind of more or less settled into being with a dull fog. And then quite suddenly the fog had gone, you know, just when I wasn't looking, it just suddenly cleared. And it strikes me that that's very much like what it is in my practice in meditation. It's a dull fog, and you struggle with it and you're aware of it, and it's just dull and miserable, and then somehow or other, when you're not looking, suddenly something seems to shift. There's a kind of letting go of the struggle, and it's all bright and clear again. So anyway, I was sitting in this kuti, really enjoying being there and allowing the impressions of Amaravati and the community here just to sort of just fall away a little bit. I don't know how it is for you, but like when I've start a retreat after having been quite engaged, usually the first few days there's a kind of remembering and a sort of impressions, like sort of the memories of what's been happening and how they've affected me. And so just actually just had a chance just to allow those to fall away. And a very nice walking path. I did a lot of walking practice, which I find very helpful. And the heater broke down, which wasn't a major disaster. I kind of got into my hot water bottle and blanket practice. And then we got this heater man to come and repair the heater. And that was very funny because I had to be in there to show him where the heater was. But as I explained, the kuti was absolutely minute. So I was kind of sitting on the bed, kind of squashed against the wall. And this heater man came in and he was completely gobsmacked. He said he'd never, ever, ever seen such a building. And I said, I was kind of quite amused to think of this little wagon as a building. I said, it's more like a dwelling. And anyway, he came in and lay on the floor in front of the heater and kind of fiddled around. And we thought he'd got it working again, but actually he hadn't. That was all right. And all the while I was kind of just each day waiting to, I sort of look out waiting to see Diana coming along to, with the news of a telephone call about Patricia, but nothing happened. You know, so days went by, and I thought, well, this is strange. Because when I saw her, she said, well, you know, her kidneys weren't working, and she thought it would be about a day before she died. And so I really thought it was about time, really. And eventually I couldn't contain my curiosity any longer, so I phoned up the hospital, and they said, well, yes, she's very comfortable. Quite peaceful, and people are coming to see her. And after that phone call, Diana said, well, are you going to go and see her? And I thought, no. I'm on retreat. And I waited another couple of days, and suddenly I thought, actually, maybe I will. I had this rail voucher, so I could go very easily, and I'd discovered that the hospital was very close to the station, and so it was actually very easy. I thought, well, maybe I'll go. And I phoned up and said, would you like me to come? So I'd like to come, and she said, yeah. Don't you really like it if I could go and be there? So I had 15 minutes to take a shower and pack and get in the car with Diana to go to the station. And we caught the train and travelled up to London. I got a 3-day return because she was going, apparently they'd given her some medicine that was going to enable her to keep going even without any kidneys working, because she had some legal things that she wanted to sort out. And but she was going to stop taking it the day that I was arriving. So I thought, well, 3 days. So took this 3-day return ticket and went up to London and arrived in Clapham Junction and walked through Clapham with my kind of belongings. Clapham's a very interesting area, actually. I mean, there's hardly a single sort of native-born British person lives there. All different nationalities. A lot of Muslims, Hindus. Yeah, it was quite fun walking through Clapham and then across Prince Albert Bridge and up to the hospital. I knew a few people in London who I had felt, you know, close friends of the community, and I felt, you know, I was fairly certain that if I needed help, that I would be able to contact them, and they could offer me a place to stay or food if I needed it. So it was a little bit of a step into the unknown. But I was very clear that I was just going to see how things unfolded. So I found Patricia in her room and sat down, and we talked, and the nurses came and went, and this evening came, and I hadn't really made any plans, and it was obvious that it was quite okay to stay in the hospital. I asked the nurses if I could sleep on the floor, and they said, no, we'll bring you a bed. And offered me a bed to stay in the same room. In the end, I decided just to sleep on the floor. I had my robes, I had my alms bowl, a couple of blankets, just lay down on the floor. And then in the morning, Patricia ordered toast for breakfast. By this time, she'd more or less stopped eating. So we ordered toast for breakfast and then the vegetarian option at lunchtime. And I think the catering lady was absolutely delighted because she'd been very concerned because Patricia wasn't eating. And she was actually trying to trick her into eating more. So I think when larger helpings were arriving and being consumed, I think the catering lady was very, very happy. We never told her what was happening. And so the days went by. And basically, we had a really good time. It was good that we'd done our kind of weeping at the first meeting because that was kind of out of the way. And we just, you know, Patricia slept, and every now and again we'd have a chat and a bit of a laugh. She had a phone, so people would phone up. And talk to people on the phone, and just had a really, really lovely time. We talked about the funeral, you know, what we were going to do. You know, I said I was thinking of inviting Ajahn Suchito to come, and you know, is that something she would like? She said yes, and of course you two do it together. And then a lot of discussion about who was going to officiate at the crematorium, and the various wild ideas that we had about who might do that. First she'd said she'd like to have an Anglican service at the crematorium because she was christened as an Anglican, and she thought that's what her relatives would like. But over the days it got more and more wild, our planning for the crematorium. And there was one idea to have this healer who'd come one day, and really, really lovely man. And he'd apparently done funerals before, and turned out that he was a pagan high priest. And that was one idea. Anyway, in the end, one of her friends was invited. It was very interesting just to notice the different stages of the dying process. Since the very first diagnosis, incredible a sense of distress and struggle, and then a feeling of really having to sort things out on the practical level, and concern about the will, who would have what, and how things would be sorted out. And then this healer coming to visit, and the whole thing had happened much more quickly than we had expected. I mean, she thought she'd had several months, and things developed much more rapidly. And the healer came, and he was obviously kind of very connected on different levels, and And he was working on her, and he said, "Yes, yes." He said, "They're all gathering up there and waiting for you, and you know, you'll probably go quite soon." And I was actually very touched to hear what he was saying. And he said, "Yeah, I think you're probably just about ready." And he turned to me and he said, "You know, do you think she's ready?" And I couldn't actually speak at that point. I just nodded. And I'd actually wanted to ask him, you know, how I could help her, you know, because it's clear that when you die, there's a tremendous amount to be let go of. You know, you're enormous, like in our lifetime, we make many, many, many connections, you know, both material things. We have like material possessions, we have areas of interest, you know, things that we are concerned about and interested in. We have causes, we have things that we put energy into. Like, I don't know about you, but for myself, I have a tremendous sense of investment and interest, say, just in the Sangha, in the community here. You know, tremendous, you know, I really care about it, and I have a lot of interest in supporting and quite dedicated, in a way, to it. And then to various, like, friendships, you know, friends and relations, and a lot of connections and interest with people, you know, concern for their welfare. And, you know, I could see that, you know, my own presence, you know, it could either be something supportive and helpful, but it could also be, you know, if I wasn't skillful in how I held the situation, that it, you know, there's a sense in which I could perhaps have, you know, hindered her leaving, sort of held her back in some way. And I had really wanted to ask this healer, you know, for advice about how I could help, but unfortunately I was so kind of choked up when he was there that I couldn't manage. So that was all right. And he left her a little bottle of special oil. He said, you know, if you feel kind of that you need support and help, you know, during the, you know, and strength, extra strength during the time that you're going, just, you know, sniff some of this oil. So I kind of noticed the oil there, and during the next days I was using it just as much as she was. But it was interesting after his visit, because at that point it was as though her realization of what was happening sort of reached a deeper level. You know, it was as though that, you know, the sort of understanding that she was going to die. The reason I'm saying all of this is because it's something that's relevant for everybody. It's not just her situation, but it's as though the understanding of the process of dying just goes through many, many different levels. And after he'd been, you know, she sort of said to me, she said, "Yes, I really am going to die, aren't I? I really am leaving." And you know, sort of seeing that there was some level that actually needed to really accept that, to really take it on board. And it was also very helpful having, you know, being able to talk with the nursing staff who were there, because they've obviously had a lot of experience of people dying. And actually, if I'd been a little bit clued in the first time I went to see her, I would have realized that actually it was going to take quite a while, because actually she still had lots of energy. I could see that. You know, she wasn't ready. But then over the days that I was with her, just, you know, each day, you know, there'd be little changes. And I would check in with the nurses and sort of say, you know, and there was one very, very lovely one who kind of came and actually talked to both of us, you know, about how it would probably be. I was really impressed with the nurses. You know, they were just very, very tuned in, you know, to both to Patricia and where she was, and also to me, you know, what it was like for me. And, you know, so they one of them said, "Well, you know, either you'll just go to sleep and just get, you know, just leave in that way. Or else there'll be some kind of a crisis, and then you'll slip into unconsciousness and go." And you know, she actually said to Patricia, you know, how does that sound to you? You know, how do you feel about that? And really very lovely, just the sense of ease with the dying process. And I realized that how, and this was the first time I'd ever been with anybody who was dying, but I had the sense that in this culture, you know, mostly, people aren't very at ease with people dying and the whole idea of death. And you know, so I was quite, I mean, I felt very privileged to be so intimately involved with the whole process and, you know, being able to actually just go through it step by step. And just actually noticing the appearance changing, you know, first, you know, really quite a lot of energy, and then just gradually just the skin colour changing and just getting weaker. And so gradually I had to begin to be the kind of receptionist, like when people would phone up, I would be the one that would speak with them. And you know, she had a lot of very, very close friends who used to phone up and want to talk with her, and I just had to say, well, she's too weak to talk. And this fabulous day when they phoned up from Chithurst, Sister Tanya actually rang and chatted with me, and Ajahn Sucitto was there. So we talked, and Ajahn Sucitto said, well, you know, please, I want to say to Patricia how much I appreciated her, and yeah. He said a few things. I said, well, maybe you can say that to her. And I asked Patricia, I said, is it okay? And they had this absolutely hilarious conversation about coffins. And at one point, Patricia just roared with laughter. And apparently Ajahn Sucitto was saying how he thought that he rather fancied mauve, that he would like to have a kind of pale mauve coffin. And Patricia said to him, well, don't you want to have ochre and, you know, like the monk's robes? And Ajahn Sucitto says, well, I think I've done what I can in ochre. And he's going to, thought it'd be good to go out in pink mauve. And so far from being a kind of terrible, awful, kind of mournful, dreadful experience, it was actually very light. And the whole process was very light and very calm. The last evening, she became very, very restless. And it was quite difficult because they'd given her some pain medication, which actually, it works just by relaxing the whole body, because the pain was coming from like cramping in the muscles. And so they gave her this medication to relax her. And so she was the muscles were very, very relaxed, and she actually slept for most of the day. And then in the evening she woke up. So she was quite alert mentally, but because the muscles were so relaxed, she couldn't actually move. And so this experience of terrible restlessness, but not actually being able to move, it was quite frightening, just sort of being stuck in a body that couldn't move. And so, you know, we had to kind of turn her over and actually just move her limbs. And I had to clean her teeth, which I've never done that before for somebody. Quite an intimate thing to do for somebody, cleaning their teeth and just bathe her, because she was unable to do it for herself. And the nurse, you know, agreed that she would come back every couple of hours, you know, to move her to a different position. And so we just kind of, I sat quietly with her, and after about 10 minutes she said, what time is it? So it's 9:10. Oh. And I could tell it was going to be a very, very difficult 2 hours, because every few minutes she said, what time is it? And so I massaged her and we talked, and I did a load of chanting, and Eventually we kind of got to the end of the 2 hours and I went and I spoke with the nurse and she said, oh yes, that means the end is quite close. Quite often, this condition that gets, terminal agitation, you get very kind of edgy. And so she was very, very edgy and agitated. Anyway, they helped her to rest a little bit, and I just stayed awake and sat with her through the night. And then her breathing began to change as well. So the next day I had her breakfast, and then I had her lunch. I'd arranged to go and have a bath and a rest in a friend's house. Close by, and so I said, and another friend had arranged to come and sit with her. So I explained to the other friend, you know, where things were and how to look after her. And I said to Patricia, I'm going to go and have a bath and a rest, and I'll be back in an hour or two. I said, don't go without me. Unless you have to. I said, you can go if you need to, but so I went off and rested, and we had a call saying that she was going. So I came back and we just sat with her. And there were three of us, three women friends, just sat quietly. And it was an extraordinary time. It was the evening time, just as the light was changing. Around about 4:30, 5 o'clock, and just sat there and watched the breath. And there was a point where there was just a little breath and then the out breath. And then not another in breath. It was very interesting just to see this kind of quite still. And we just sat very, very quietly. Her mouth was open. So after a few, 15 or 20 minutes, I did the Buddhist chanting, and then one of the women who was there just got up and tried to close her mouth, but it wouldn't close. It was very relaxed, it just sort of flopped open. So I thought, well, never mind, because no one's going to see, it doesn't matter. We were just talking among ourselves. After a few minutes, his friend looked up and said, she's closed her mouth. So we sat some more. I think one of the strongest senses of the whole experience was just really how unbelievably ordinary it was, and how the fact that this is something that's going to happen to each one of us at some stage. And I don't mean that in a kind of heavy, negative way, but just more that this is part and parcel of this human existence. In some sense, we're incredibly fortunate that we're practicing in this way and that we have these teachings and we have the opportunity to live and to cultivate in a very, very skillful, very wholesome way, and to be continually reviewing our lives and continually actually looking at what our life is about and what's really important, what's really worth investing energy and interest in. Um, No, and in some sense, Patricia was also very fortunate because she'd been practicing meditation for a great number of years, and she was she came here quite regularly, so she was had a very keen understanding and attunement to Dhamma. And she'd explored it within many different religious traditions, some of you may have realized. So for her, it was actually as easy as it could have been. You know, during the last days, there were times when I had to remind her that, you know, she'd be getting worried about, she has this cottage, what was going to happen with that, or she'd be worrying about, you know, particular friends, if they were all right, and, you know, so I just have to say to her, you know, look, it's all right, don't worry, you know, things are going to be all right, you know, you don't have to be concerned with that anymore. This is time to, you know, you're doing something different now, and, you know, it's good just to give your full attention to this different process that you're going through, and, you know, we'll take care of that, and just really trust that things will be taken care of. And, you know, in some ways it's quite a difficult thing, I think, for all of us to really trust that things will be taken care of. We feel we have to just hold everything together. And I think this retreat time is a very, very good time. I mean, particularly people who are very conscientious and diligent. I was talking with somebody today who was saying how, you know, having been on retreat for a period of time, they couldn't actually think very clearly, they couldn't organize things very well. And I say, well, that's really, really good. It's a sign of just actually really being able to let go of things that, you know, it's not necessary to attend to for this time. And it's very, very, a very useful exercise to just experiment with just sort of setting things aside and just attending to the absolute essentials for a period of time. And when we learn how to do that, then we can pick up things quite consciously and then put them down, rather than a kind of obsessive or compulsive feeling that we have to kind of hold on to everything and we have to be useful. You know, our lives have to be useful, and if we're not useful, then we're not actually really doing our bit, pulling our weight. And so we can be very compulsive about being useful. But when we practice like this, we have an opportunity to actually pick up our duties, pick up our responsibilities in a very measured, very mindful way. So it's not that we don't care, it's not that we're not concerned, it's not that we're not responsible, but we can say, okay, now it's appropriate, now it's the time for me to be doing this, now it's the time for me to be taking care of this. You know, we give it our full attention. But then when that's not necessary anymore, then we put it down. And like Ajahn Upeka, during the first weeks of the retreat, she was looking after the support group, taking care of the Anagiri cars, and she, you know, she picked up those duties and she really gave it her best shot. She did it, you know, very, very, with a lot of diligence, very conscientiously. And now she's having some time of self-retreat, and you know, it's all set aside. She's having a great time. But, you know, this ability to pick things up when it's appropriate and then to put them down when it's not necessary. It's useful to contemplate, you know, why that is sometimes difficult. You know, I realize for myself sometimes it's difficult if there's been a tremendous investment of self. You know, like if my, you know, being responsible for something is like, if I make it into part of me. This is like when we take birth, it's like a rebirth, you know, being reborn as, I don't know, the kitchen coordinator, or reborn as the, when I used to be the newsletter editor, that was an interesting one. And it's not that it's bad. I mean, it's lovely when people do take on you know, perform acts of service for the community, or, you know, do good things. But when there's a tremendous amount of self-investment, then there's a tremendous potential for suffering. You know, because when that position is challenged, or You know, if we identify too closely with it, then we can get over concerned about how things are working out, and you know, we can really suffer when things don't go the way that we feel they should. So just being able to pick things up when it's appropriate, put things down when it's not appropriate, adapt and change. And there's a very impressive example of this I found on Friday during the funeral ceremonies, because I mean, most of you were here when we had the ceremony in the temple, and that went very well. I thought it was really a really lovely occasion. And then we went to the crematorium, and a very, very good friend of mine called Dana had been invited to officiate at the ceremony in the crematorium, and you know, she'd planned what she was going to do. She was going to be the one who was going to like welcome people and give a little introduction. There were going to be a few moments of silence and contemplation, and then the sort of program of different things that were going to happen, readings and so on, and then at the end she would give this blessing. And so it was quite an important role, really, and a very lovely thing to be able to offer. Anyway, we set off to the crematorium. We had plenty of time, so we thought, and we set off, and the car I was in was leading the way because Alan was driving, he knew the way. And then there was the hearse, and then there was a whole string of other people behind. We went in a kind of convoy, quite a long way, and people had maps to follow. And one thing I hadn't reckoned on was the fact that hearses actually go more slowly than ordinary cars, so we actually had to go quite slowly. And then there was a whole lot of traffic. We got caught in traffic, so we were a little bit slow. So we arrived about 5 minutes late for the ceremony in the crematorium. And those of you who had experience of crematoriums will know that they're incredibly particular about time. You know, you have a set slot, and after that you're out no matter what. So it was obvious that, you know, because we were 5 minutes late, we were going to have 5 minutes less for the ceremony. Anyway, so we went in and we sat down, and the lady funeral director was very cool. She said, okay, well, you know, is so and so here? She had this list of people who were going to be participating, and you know, most of them weren't there. So the minutes were ticking by, you know, 10 minutes late, 12 minutes late. So she said, well, I'm just going to have to bring in the coffin, we're just going to have to begin. So only two of the coffin bearers were there. So the two funeral directors, these funeral director ladies, carried the coffin with the other two people. So they came in and put the coffin down, and then the funeral director lady got up the program and said, right, is so-and-so here? And so-and-so wasn't there. So she said, okay, what about so-and-so and so-and-so? Unfortunately, they were there. So these two young girls, these twins, they read poems that they'd written. And then the next person read a psalm, and then the next person did this, and the next person. And I kept looking around for Dana, because she was supposed to be officiating, but she didn't arrive and didn't arrive. And we got to the very end, and she arrived. And there was this music happening, and the funeral director ladies were opening the doors for everybody to go out. And Dana, she had this blessing that she was going to read, and she just wouldn't budge. She wasn't going to be pushed out by the funeral director lady. She just stood there, and with great dignity and incredible presence, read out this blessing, a very beautiful, quite short blessing. Just read it out, very composed, with a lovely smile, and read out this blessing. And it was just great. And I thought, I bet I couldn't have done that. To be able to actually come in 25 minutes late, knowing that there was only half hour slot, and just actually have that composure to let go of all of the plans, what should have been happening, and just actually do that. So it was a great tribute to her mindfulness and presence. As I said, I'm sure I would have been really, really upset and agitated. So that's kind of something that certainly I can aspire to be able to maintain that presence, even when things have gone so kind of, in inverted commas, disastrously wrong. So just this ability to be able to let go and to keep changing and adapting, letting go. So in a sense, this lifestyle, this way we live, the reflections, the recollections, the Buddha's injunction, his encouragement to continuously reflect on our mortality, is an incredibly useful preparation for us. So that when the time comes for us to actually let the whole thing go, I have a sense it'll be a lot easier for us than for people who perhaps have not cultivated in this way, people who've invested all of their energy in, say, acquiring enormous amounts of wealth, in relationships, in maintaining a sense of physical beauty and well-being. You know, these things are things that there's no way that we can hold on to these. And to be able to go just with dignity and grace, rather than with a lot of fear and remorse and regret. So that the last breath is just a very simple exhalation, just a slipping away. A very, very beautiful moment. It's not anything to be afraid of. Very, very lovely. In fact, Patricia, when she stopped taking her kind of medication that was maintaining her, you know, she had her last kind of meeting or discussion about her will and sorted it all out with the solicitor. She said, oh, I feel as though I'm going on my holidays now. I've always been interested in adventure, so it's like a great adventure, looking forward to it in some way. And so rather than investing in maintaining physical strength and well-being, rather than investing in acquiring enormous numbers of possessions or acquiring a special status or position, we have the encouragement, we have the opportunity to invest in cultivating mindfulness. Just cultivating this quality of presence. Just learning how to be present in every moment. You know, during this retreat time, obviously, presence in meditation, being with the breath, being with observing the states of mind, the changing mind states, cultivating presence just in daily life activities. And then once the retreat is over, we have maybe more challenging conditions within which to cultivate mindfulness. You know, times when we're in interaction with one another, when maybe we have difficulties with one another, when things don't work out the way that we would like them to, when we feel troubled or angry or upset or irritated or despairing or discouraged or bored, or even when we're excited and delighted and looking forward to something, just to see that the investment is in actually just being with this condition as it is right now, and really taking an interest in this moment, rather than struggling to get away from it, to change it, to make it otherwise, have it otherwise. Cultivating this sense of ease, this sense of presence, no matter what might be happening for us. So that even when things go horribly wrong, we can be present with that. We can maintain a sense of ease, a sense of dignity. And if we lose that sense of ease and dignity, when there's mindfulness, we can be aware of that too. So it's a very kind of this deep awareness, this watcher, that which knows when things are fine and easeful, knows when things have gone horribly wrong. Like over this last while, obviously since Patricia died, I've had times when I felt really, really upset. You know, it comes over you all of a sudden, you know, not expecting it, and suddenly somebody will say something, or you'll remember something, or you'll see something. Just this great, enormous amounts of emotion. And it was interesting to see how incredibly all right that was. You know, people round about might have felt concerned, but, you know, with this mindfulness practice, you find that it doesn't really matter. You know, if you're happy, that's fine. If you're sad, that's fine too. And a sense of ease, of equanimity, so that you can actually feel what's happening moment by moment without it being a source of tremendous... pulls you away from just that sense of knowing, that sense of watchfulness and ease. So I noticed that Sister Bodhipala's got the book with her lines. So maybe that's a signal that I've said enough for this evening. Offer all of this for contemplation, reflection, and wishing for everybody perfect liberation, perfect ease in this very lifetime, so that the moment of death will be a moment of ease and delight, perhaps. Who knows? Anyone?